You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this should be going out on the 20th of March, 2024. I have a bit of a cold, so I may not sound the same, but I can assure you the brain is still working as it should. And it won't surprise you to know that I'm going to talk about the presidential elections in Russia, and contrasting that with the total lack of elections in Ukraine and, of course, the fake ones in America, the only even vaguely democratic state in this, with far more parties and candidates, is Russia. Now, the Western press, you know, like the UK Independent, you know, they don't pretend to be even remotely even-handed. They don't think they have any obligation to do that. These are simply editorials based on the assumption that no one knows enough. And especially in Britain and the EU, where most of any pro-Russian periodical or website is banned. So the new media law in the EU is an Orwellian joke. Vladimir Putin, of course, won this against a slate of very uninteresting candidates, every one of whom knew that they had no chance. Putin scored a bit higher than his popularity rating, which hovers around 80%, 75 to 80% most of the time anyway. But we have to understand why and how it is that he won. Now, I know I've gone through this before. But first of all, you know, these candidates are extremely uninteresting. Elections go on. I think this was the first time it went on for 3 days, which is a unique situation. Since the Constitution was updated, we talked about that in 2020, this is the first fully national election. And because of the amendments to the Constitution, Putin's previous terms didn't count, because the term itself went from 4 to 6 years a few years ago. So this would be his fifth time, and the Russian population and opinion polls says it really doesn't matter. Even if you violate the Constitution, run as many times as you can. They also had online voting. And of course, places like Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, Luhansk, for the first time, are able to participate. And needless to say, we know where they went. Votes during warfare are normal for the Americans. It happened in 1996. It happened in 2000. Given the nature of the wars in Chechnya at the time. Of course, the scale of what's happening now is a little different. But as you know, in Ukraine, there's not going to be any elections. He would never expose himself to any kind of election unless it's just a one-party operation. It was a very uninteresting election and set of campaigns. The whole signature idea, that you have to get a certain number of signatures if you're not part of a parliamentary system, if you're not part of a parliamentary bloc or party. So people like, you know, Anatoly Bartashev, who never got close. I think it's 500,000, something like that. The liberal Boris Nadezhdin, who was a student of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and the Yukos oligarch. Sergei Malenkovich, who was a Siberian member of the Communist Party. They didn't even, they had no chance. They had no chance to get the requisite number of signatures. And the head of Russian Freemasonry, Andrei Bogdanov, who was the head of the Grand Lodge since 2007, they declared a certain candidacy and just withdrew it immediately. I don't understand the point of all of that. Of course, Putin, as always, ran as an independent. And so the people he faced in the elections were part of a parliamentary party, so the signature requirement didn't count. And it's really hard to rank how uninteresting they are. Nikolai Karatonov, Communist Party, he's 75 years old. He's been around a long time. He was in Duma in 1990, part of the Agrarian Party, I think, back then. And he was nominated ahead of Gennady Zhuganov, who has been a standard bearer there for a long time. And Zhuganov at least has some charisma. Karatonov has zero. But the fact that he got 13.7% of the vote is really pretty extraordinary. I'm not sure why he ran or why that party continues to run, since they don't tend to differ from Putin in any real way. They use China as their big example of how to develop. Of course, Putin uses the same thing. He does advocate the withdrawal from the IMF, which is something I certainly would endorse. So some criticism of the Ukraine war. And then, of course, the phony Liberal Democratic Party, which initially was a Jewish liberal party under Zhirinovsky. And I had completely forgotten that he died in 2022. So they have a guy named Leonid Slutsky. And just like Zhirinovsky, he's been all over the place. He's a bit more respectable than Zhirinovsky was. He doesn't make the, strategically outrageous statements that Zhirinovsky did when Yeltsin was trying to run things. Again, in many ways, he doesn't differ from Putin except by degree. You know, he wants the legislation to be more strict on foreign agents, wants the military operation to grow much more quickly. And then, of course, he two very uninteresting guys who were saying that Putin is right, we just can do it a little bit better. And then the other one is Vladislav Davankov, 40 years old, and really is someone who is as close to a liberal as possible. I mean, coming out and saying that you're a liberal in Russian politics means you're going to get nothing. So this New People Caucus, which then became a party, is simply your capitalist party. I've read their actually very lengthy introduction and basic positions. I think much of it is probably beyond the average voter. I mean, it uses the word ontology in its title. And he received what, just a bit over 5%. He was in the Duma, I think in 2021, Budget Tax Committee. He's, of course, all of these men are very wealthy. And he ran for mayor, got roughly the same. So, he got, that was his mayoral candidacy. He got 5%. Actually, he got not quite 4% this time around. But these are typical. 2024, ultimately, I think I'm overstating it. you know, Slutsky got 3%. Ivankov got almost 4%. And the Communist Party candidate actually only received just over 4%. Everything else went to Putin, and you had record, you had 75 million votes cast. The communist figure, I'm sorry, that was in 2004 he received, not quite 14%. So he's done this before. So they're much, much lower this time around. Always in single digits. This is pretty normal. The Communist Party used to do better. But of course, this is in the middle of a war. Putin is well aware that everyone's simply trying to imitate him, saying that they could do it better. So actually, these totals in 2024 are much lower than their previous totals. 3-4%, which is, you know, a lot of what Russians haven't even heard of these people. They've done much better in the past. So why does he continue to win? I mean, apart from warfare, apart from everything else. And you know, I think it's interesting, first of all, that their largest turnout numbers were in Siberia. The Chechen Republic, and then, of course, that's not in Siberia, but the Kemerovo region, Republic of Tuva, very close together in southern Siberia. They had over 90% turnout and huge majorities for Putin. But he wins for reasons that I've been talking about for two decades. You know, the oligarchs used to be Western agents. They were going to be the next ruling class. When Putin came out and broke their back, illegally so, not only made him popular from there on in, but of course angered the West, winning the war in Chechnya and Georgia, and now, you know, mopping up the operation in Ukraine, freeing Russia from debt bondage, huge reserves, all throughout the 2000s. You had a first-rate economy, far more stable than anything in the EU or the US, and survived all of these shocks and made sanctions pretty much irrelevant. I mentioned the Georgian War, the attacks on Russian peacekeepers there in 2008. Just, you know, it was Western sponsored just before the Olympics that year. Crimea's reunification made him immensely popular, especially everything that happened in 2014. The Eurasian Union was another popular one, more special on this one. And of the deep ties with China, and then now India and sometimes Turkey. The victory in Syria, the total humiliation of the West there, the exposure of the West as the sponsor of ISIS and Daesh, and still, you know, always holding out peacekeepers to the West while being part of the Belt and Road, actually a central part of the Belt and Road. The American defeat in Afghanistan, which was, you know, brokered by Russia in the peace talks there, and the Americans trying to save face after they were defeated. A complete revolution in weapons production, which was an explicit goal of his. The hypersonic so-called super weapons. Just that first decade, you're talking about billions and billions, 400 in a very short period of time, on the socioeconomic modernization of the country. And to remain competitive, all the old nonsense about it, breaking down infrastructure in the 1990s has been corrected in most places. Of course, in Ukraine, that has not been the case. And not only this victory in Ukraine, but it's done with fairly, you know, relatively low casualties for a war of this scale. Now, once he was elected by this enormous margin, and he has said this sort of thing before, but everyone knows his victory was out of the, you know, no one had a chance. These are really an awful group of challengers, all trying to be just like him. But the independent, sovereign Russia idea is central. That wasn't the case necessarily in the beginning. And both the sanctions and the war, the fact that Ukraine is being depopulated. You have idiot, dumb Americans of Ukrainian background who think supporting this war is a good thing while there's nothing left over there. They want to believe the American press, the American military very, very badly. And his speech after his victory, he mentions all of this. He mentions the idea of this revolution in Russian weaponry, which is a state-controlled, state-owned infrastructure in Russia, unlike the American version. Ultimately, Putin got almost 90% of the vote, similar to his popularity rating. He mentions that, if we were completely mono-ethnic, that would still be extraordinary. But when you have a multi-ethnic federation, that's even beyond that. Unity, of course, was the big theme under Russia as an ethnic group. The successful anti-sabotage operations, and these were simply from the Ukrainian side, from the American side, these are terrorist operations. They're hitting civilian targets. And this last one, this 5,000 force trained by the West, their losses were about 50%. Those who actually got into Russian territory were completely destroyed. And he said one stupid thing. He tried to claim that this paramilitary unit that tried to infiltrate Russia, he compares them to members of the Vlasov army. And Putin got very vehement, called them traitors and scum, fighting on the side of the Germans. He said they're the same people who, which really is just historically absurd and is an open endorsement, at least, of what he considers the Soviet Union. Now, attacking Vlasov is a big problem, not necessarily because of, anything. Vlasov didn't have a chance either, but trying to compare the two is a terrible idea. But he dropped that pretty quickly and then said that there's going to be a buffer zone. Maybe the peace treaty will be a buffer zone in central Ukraine. It'll be a security zone long enough so it will be very difficult to try to launch any kind of a sneak attack, which has been going on recently. I don't know where these 5,000 men came from. I guarantee you many of them are foreigners. But the only criterion he has for those who now oppose him is that if you have a neutral Ukraine and, drop the obsession with warfare, we can work together. But we all know that's not going to happen. Zelensky is taking orders from the U.S., is not going to hold elections. He's extremely unpopular. And Putin is even wondering who to negotiate with over there. The Chinese have refused to be a part of any peace talks that don't involve Russia. Can you imagine not involving Russia in their own war, on their own territory? And he accuses, as we all know, the regime of wanting World War III as possibly the only thing that could rescue the Western economy. Now, you've all read the nonsensical articles about this election, and I think RT had said something along these lines. It was the foreign ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, who is dealing with Germany. Of course, months in advance, they had already written their condemnation of these elections, knowing full well what was going to happen. But the West itself guaranteed this huge victory. It's their own arrogance that forged a unity that, while existing before, was never quite this explicit. The media and foreign ministries of different countries in the EU all say the same thing. They use the same slogans. They use the same words. The unelected American president, who is there by fraud, of course, projected all of this onto Russia, saying they're there by fraud. and you have many press outlets banned in the EU, and they're talking about elections. And of course, this is a form of projection. This is how Western leaders deal with the fact that, under no circumstances, under any conditions, could they ever come close to this level of popularity. And since it hasn't gone down, but they, you know, they're held in contempt, they wish they would do anything to be what Putin is. So they tend to project all of their problems onto him. Putin has caused the humiliation of the West militarily and economically over and over and over again. And Ukraine situation is the most blatant, even more so than the Afghan version. The fact that sanctions don't mean anything. Very few people know why. I've been talking about this for years. But that's all this is. I know Paul Craig Roberts said that because Americans deal with vote rigging every day for years, they just assume everyone else rigs elections as well. The day of the election, or that weekend, the American press, again, same thing, same words, same slogans, put in the same way over and over again. Anyone who actually has access to the information can't take the American electoral process seriously at all. It's really hard. You don't even have to be a Russian nationalist to understand and agree with Putin's basic approach to things. You know, the spending on families, or the tax breaks, all the economic things that I've mentioned, I've been talking about for a long time. You know, Putin is unlike anything that the West could produce. And to think that there's any hope here, you know, the power of this complex, the media, military complex, the regime, the sheer size of it, the only part of the economy that's doing well in the West, not to mention the influence of the CIA and everything else. Well, Russia is a very easy enemy to invent because it is this huge black spot. I mean, China is a little more difficult, but even that's not hard. And of course, they're trying to provoke both at the same time. And when you consider the Israeli situation, where the American government had to admit that they have, you know, they are deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure, just like Ukraine does, all they end up doing is projecting this onto whoever the enemy is. And whether it be China in the western part of the country, in, you know, Tibet, or Russia anywhere that the regime has an interest, they simply are laying out what they're doing elsewhere. And in the Israeli case, whatever kind of authority the West ever had, especially the U.S. ever had, is long gone. For the regime to try to create yet another war in Iran, that would be an important way for the CIA to send its forces from Iran and Azerbaijan into Russia to create an Islamic Russian war, as they tried to do unsuccessfully in Chechnya. But when you have open borders, when you're deliberately replacing white people, when you deliberately destroy whatever little bit of unity the American Federation ever had, when you have a situation where nobody in power in the Western world represents the ethnic base of the country, the most productive elements of the country, that is to say, white elements. Governments in the West represent only their functionaries of the regime. And he makes the obvious point that, well, Donald Trump tried very weakly and, yeah, as a rear guard action to change that. And if you want to talk about how fraudulent the Western political process is, the attacks on Donald Trump, knowing full well that Biden was not elected, he can't be, he can't campaign, he doesn't know where he is most of the time, something's going to happen. Getting him off the ballot was plan A. Plan B, who knows? I came across an article on a mayor in France, Fabien Roussel. Actually, he was mayor of the commune of Talon in the south, part of the Republican Party there. and he went to the mayor decided to suspend and possibly expel one of his deputies, Cyril Gauthier, because he went and became an international observer, one of the many international observers overseeing this election. He was a deputy mayor. Rouenet is the main one. And he was a deputy mayor in charge of public services and planning. March 15th to 17th, he was over there. And Rouenet, the mayor, said, well, my deputy was directly appointed by the Kremlin. He says, I know it's true. I can't tell you how I know, but... And because of that make-believe situation, that's why he suspended him. And will maybe expelled from the party, and God knows he's still in Russia as far as I know at the time, this is being recorded. But his fate, I mean, he's going to end up in prison. And when he returns, anything is possible. And of course, the claim he made, again, these people aren't exactly knowledgeable. And he said, well, Gauthier said the elections were free and fair, as did most international observers. He said, well, that can't possibly be true because Navalny wasn't involved. The true representative of the opposition, well, very few people. When he ran for office before, he got 3-4% of the vote. If you go back, I talked about Navalny at great length. And they think that he, not a whole lot of people heard of him until he got in trouble for the fifth or sixth time. Gauthier's, the Republican Party, is going to expel him entirely. Anyone who endorses the electoral process in Russia is not going to be a French citizen. So, in response to this, the German comments and everything else, Ella Pamphilova, who is actually the chief of the Russian Central Election Commission, which is very strict, you know, under the law, said that there were just over 1,000 observers. I think 1,100 was the final tally from 130 countries. There was Europe, North America, and she applauded them. They did see that there was a few. There was always going to be some irregularity, not like the American version, but. Yeah, they reported a few minor things here and there, but they refused to. These observers wouldn't listen to the media lies. And in coming and seeing how, so this man, this deputy mayor, probably is not going to be the last to come under attack here. And you want to talk about projection. When you have Zelensky, or, you know, through Sergei Denichenko, who said, couple of days ago, that Zelensky is essentially a one-party state. He makes all the decisions once, you know, he confers with the Americans, and that he's going to create a what they call a dictatorship, because, you know, that's the only way that they're going to win this war. And Denichenko is in the Rada, member of his Servant of the People nonsense party. He came out and said, well, the only way we can win is to have a dictatorship. Zelensky, as you know, has said that he's going to, because being a Jew himself, he's going to create an Israeli-type security arrangement. Now, it's true, Demchenko said the quote-unquote Ukrainian people, they're too freedom-loving to accept this, although they've been cowed and have been forced to accept precisely this for 2 years. And they've been using this as an excuse to centralize power for a while. This war has been an excuse to ban most media, to ban most parties, to ban church, because almost all of them in Ukraine have some ties to Russia. And this claim that there's going to be a March election under martial law, which can never be lifted, and he's not going to stand for a wartime election. It happens all the time, but we know why he can't possibly run for election. Partially because they're drafting women. They're lowering the age. I think that idiot senator said that they need to lower the age of the draft. They want another 500,000 people. They're going to start shooting draft dodgers, which I think they've done anyway. This is what the Americans have put there, what they have created, let alone what they tolerate and what they finance. And all of this, you put all of this together, and you realize exactly why Putin got almost 90% of the vote, and the other three, you know, really just boring. The only one who isn't boring is Dvankov. His party is, I think it's a disguised, you know, Khodorkovsky kind of oligarchy, but at least the program is interesting. It's lengthy. It's generally philosophical. But other than the communists, none of these guys do very well. You know, Russia has a far freer press than the U.S. They have far more parties. They have far more methods by which you can get on the ballot. In the U.S., it's out of the question. And even the Liberal Democratic Party seems to have recovered after the death of Zhirinovsky, because I don't really think, at least my impression so far, is that Slutsky doesn't seem to be that bad of a guy. But I'm still not sure, when he didn't say much in opposition, what the point of his. And then he starts his campaign and says, I'm not going to win. I'm not sure what's the point of running if you're telling your people you don't expect to win, he said. But Dvankov is very circumspect about his ties with the West. He claims he doesn't trust them. He wants peace in Ukraine like everyone else does, but on Russian terms, so I don't know how that differs from anybody else. And he says Western governments will not negotiate with us because their business opportunities available in Ukraine are too lucrative. Of course, we've been saying that for a long time. So I'm not sure why any of these guys are bothering to run, because even in their, at their best, their platforms, their public speeches aren't that different from anything Putin's saying. And that just goes to show how legitimately popular he is. And there's got to be at least some members of the regime who are aware of this. Now, most of the time, it's simply ignorance. Don't overestimate the ability of these people, including amongst the academics. But you put all of this together, and you have a very, very good reason. I even overestimated their totals in the beginning of this program. They're far lower than I expected. Just over 4%, just over 3%. That's where the so-called opposition candidates, very circumspect about their funding, where they just, you know, they're unknown, unpopular figures saying the same thing Putin is. You know, kind of wooden, uninteresting. Kartonov in the Communist Party, really just a poor soul. Ultimately, it came down to saying that we can do Putin better than Putin does. No wonder no one's gonna vote for them, especially when they come out and say, I don't think we're gonna win, we just don't have the popularity despite lots of funding. So that's the situation. Thank you everyone for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.